what part of this is just a regular sassy 13-year-old and what part of this is their ADHD?
Welcome to The Lisa Show, where we take a good look at life. Hey, it's Lisa. Last year, I did an episode with my producer, Becca, about her experience getting an ADHD diagnosis as an adult. It's a really great episode. It's tender, relatable, and if you have ADHD or suspect you might, give it a listen. It's a really good one. But after doing that episode, I realized that there's so much left to cover on this topic, including how to parent kids with ADHD. I know what my experience has been as a parent with several ADHD children, and believe me, it hasn't been perfect. I've had my struggles, and literally everyone else I know that is parenting ADHD kids has too. In fact, and this is a really hard thing for me to say, but it's really honest, if I could go back and change anything as a parent, this is what it would be. I wish I had this information about how my kids' brains work so that I could have been there to help them with the tools and give myself a little bit more empathy in the process. I want to do this better. I think we all want to parent better. And that's why I met with Diane Dempster and Elaine Taylor Klaus, the founders of Impact Parents. They specialize in coaching parents of ADHD kids, and true to form, today, yeah, right now, they're going to coach us through some very real and some very relatable struggles that parents of ADHD kids may be experiencing. And the best part, these are great parenting principles. This is a parenting philosophy that can apply to every parenting relationship, whether your kids are 4 or 24, and whether your kids have ADHD or not, it applies. So, meet Diane and Elaine.
I'm Diane Dempster. I am a parent coach and a trainer and an author. I've been working in parenting with impact for the last 15 years.
I'm Elaine Taylor Klaus, and I'm one of the co-founders of Impact Parents, originally Impact ADHD. And I like to say that I help parents stay sane while raising complex kids.
Now, before Diane and Elaine start this coaching session, I'm going to have them briefly explain what their coaching approach is so we can all be on the same page and know where they're coming from.
We are all about bringing a kind of neuro-informed coach approach to helping parents shift the way that they're in relationship with their kids to improve the communication patterns within families and to really help foster a kind of confidence and independence for kids who may struggle with life, learning, behavior, emotional issues, that kind of thing, but who really have extraordinary capacity when we adults can help them reach that.
The caveat with that is that we're not teaching parents to become their kids' coach, but we are helping them learn coaching tools so that they can support their kids in becoming independent.
I think that there's a lot of second guessing in parenting in general, but then when you throw something that is not familiar to the parent, like a neurodivergency, then that is absolutely magnified. And so I'm curious as to what are the most common maybe concerns, some might see them as complaints as well, that you hear from parents of ADHD kids?
What I hear from parents is kind of two buckets. Either I'm frustrated because I can't figure out how to make this work or help my kid do what they want to do or help my kid do what I feel like I want them to do. So there's some frustration. I happen to be a recovering yelling mom. My kids are all young adults now, but we get to that point where we're feeling like, ugh, something has to change. Why can't they just? And the other side of it is I'm feeling overwhelmed. I'm lost. I don't know what to do. Maybe the parent is also neurospicy. And so it's this sort of, I can't figure out how to get my life together. How can I possibly help my kid? And so there's kind of these two ends of the spectrum of I'm either frustrated or I'm overwhelmed and stressed. And often both of the things at the same time.
And underneath all of that is typically a lot of fear.
Yeah.
You know, and the fear of what if they don't, what if they do? The challenges, the tactical things of life, right? Life, learning, behavioral, emotional issues, like all of the challenges that show up for kids with neurodiversity show up in absolutely every aspect of their life, right? So it's happening at home, it's happening at school, it's happening at church, it's happening in clubs and after school and with their friends. And so as parents, it's really hard, one, not to be frustrated by these kids who struggle more than their peers. There's a developmental delay, so often, you know, 3 to 5 years younger than their peers in some aspects of their development, but not all, which is part of the complication. And so as parents, I think it's really easy to be fearful or frustrated. And you see what this kid has the capacity to do, and they're not hitting that. They're not realizing their capacity. And so either you worry something's really wrong with your kid, or you worry you're really messing up as a parent, or both. And either way, it kind of creates what a technical term Diane likes to describe as a hot mess.
Got it. Yes, that is a technical term, one that I'm familiar with.
Yes.
Through years and years of independent study. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Can I just pause here for a second and just say how therapeutic it is to hear other people verbalize the concerns I've had for years? I thought I could create a system and introduce something that would click for them instantly. And when it didn't, I became so frustrated in what I thought was a lack of communication, not in coming from a different place neurologically. My kids are still like, oh my gosh, if you bring out the Sharpie marker with a 3x5 cards one more time, we're gonna revolt. And so it's so validating to realize that I'm not alone in this and that my experience is actually quite common. But what's even better than that is discovering some new tools for this journey. Diane and Elaine have had several that they'd like to share with us. And the first is adopting a perspective shift regarding ADHD.
I think that there's kind of two aspects to this. One is how you're looking at yourself and how you're looking at your kid. And if I'm looking at my child, one of the key tools we talk about with perspective shift is the concept of naughty versus neurological. If you have a child with ADHD or anxiety, autism, learning differences, it really does impact all of their life. It impacts literally every aspect. These kids have challenges of executive function, and executive function is what helps us to think and to do and to feel. And we do that everywhere. And so a lot of times parents will say, well, my kid is just having a hard time at school. Well, that may be true and it may not be. And a lot of times parents will come to us and they'll say, well, what part of this is just a regular sassy 13-year-old? And what part of this is their ADHD? And so the concept of naughty versus neurological as a perspective shift is not that we know for sure whether it's naughty or neurological. I just established that if there's going to be some aspect that's going to always be neurological. But if I look at this as naughty, and I see they're being sassy, they're being disrespectful, where am I going to go? I'm going to get reactive. I might get defensive. I might go to a punishment or a consequence or a how dare you and get...
Or I might get hurt or angry.
I might get dysregulated myself. But if I can go, wow, this kid's having a hard time. Mm-hmm. And I know they have executive function challenges, or this kid is having a hard time because they're emotionally dysregulated, which is a lot of what happens is these kids get wobbly and overwhelmed. And so their ability to even navigate life and learning is different because they are overwhelmed and stressed, or we're overwhelmed and stressed. So if I can say this is a kid having a hard time, I'm going to approach it very differently. I may not make their behavior okay. Sassy kid, you know, you've got to figure out what agreements and things you want to have in place for that. But it's going to help me to go, wow, this is a kid having a hard time, which helps me to stay downregulated, which helps me to be able to problem solve in a different way.
Is my kid's behavior naughty or neurological? Asking ourselves this question can change everything about how we view and respond to our kids. So Diane and Elaine say that another tool that we can use as parents, especially with our older kids, is really great. It's a tool that I love. I think it reflects a larger parenting and really life philosophy. It's the acronym ABI.
One of the tools we teach is we call it ABI, is assume best intention. Mm-hmm. If I assume that my kid's intention is to do well if they can, I'm going to approach the dynamic very differently than if I assume they're unmotivated or they don't care or they're not trying. And so the context I want to set is how important it is to set expectations or to become aware of our perspective. And as kids get older through teen years and into young adulthoods, it becomes all the more important not only to be looking at what's our perspective, but to be looking at what's their perspective.
Yeah.
Because they are a separate, autonomous human being on their own journey. So both perspectives need to be evaluated, looked at, considered.
These two perspective shifts, always assuming best intentions and asking whether the behavior is naughty or neurological, can nudge us into a better mental space when dealing with our kids or some of the struggles that often come with ADHD. Once we're ready to tackle these struggles, Diane and Elaine say the next thing we should do is to take aim.
The first step in this coach approach model is called taking aim. As parents, we have a tendency to try to take aim on everything. And like
I want all the things.
32 things on my checklist, right? With 2 points for this and 1 point for that. Like, you know, I could not have made it more complicated in the early years. And what we've learned is that when we try to take aim on everything, our kids don't know where to focus. And we don't know where to focus. And then we're holding them accountable for everything and nobody's hitting any metrics. Mm-hmm. And then we're all frustrated and disappointed. But if we can take the marathon view and realize we're in this for the long haul. So what's the next thing we want to take aim on? Just one thing, and really narrow in, and when possible, narrow into time and place. So it's not mornings, but maybe it's getting your feet on the floor. It's not sibling issues, but it's maybe it's not getting the brother to hit the sister while at the dinner table before the food's on the table. Like the more specific we can get when we work on one thing at a time, and as parents, we're going to continue to scaffold everything else, right?
Yeah.
But if we help them work on one thing at a time, they can get some success. And the success is going to bring more success because then they feel like, oh, when I work on one thing, I can achieve it. And then when you ask me to work on something else, I have some confidence to be willing to try something else.
Can I give a specific example? It's the curiosity and the taking aim. And I'm thinking about young adults, Lisa, as an example. You know, the kids who are stuck at home, they're having a hard time figuring out. They finished college or they didn't finish college.
Or they didn't finish college.
And they're stuck in their bedrooms and maybe they're gaming more than we want them to, or they're in their little cave. And we make the assumption that, of course, they're not doing anything. They're not motivated and they would rather game, right? So that's what we think is going on. Right. But if we get curious and say, well, what's really going on is this kid has just spent 6 months dealing with something really hard and maybe they've had a big failure, or maybe they're afraid to kind of get out there and try it again, or maybe they don't understand how to make it work because like they haven't been successful. Right. And so if we see them as someone who's stuck and having a hard time with confidence or having a hard time being brave or moving forward, we're going to focus and we pick on that and we say, okay, so like, how do I help this kid build some confidence? It might have nothing to do with looking for a job. It might have everything to do with, hey, you like to cook. I have a client who did this. It's like the first thing she did, she knew her kid loved to cook. She's like, will you help me plan dinner for next week? Will you help me go shopping? And it started collaborating and engaging, low stress, more just fun. Let's be together. Actually, turned out that this parent ended up having a kid who turned into somebody who went to culinary school. But it was like through this connecting piece of it, what I'm really trying to do is get my kid out of their bedroom, not I'm trying to get my kid all the way over here to get a job.
When we narrow our aim to the thing our kids need most right now, not only is that more helpful to our kids in the long run, but it's also more helpful to us as parents. I'd rather be useful at one thing that will actually work for my kid than spinning my wheels trying to help them with a million things that never really stick. Diane and Elaine say that one of the places that is essential to take aim is with school struggles. Oof, again, hitting really close to home.
Thing I think about when I think about school is what we were talking about a few minutes ago, is getting really clear on what you're taking aim on. Is it about capturing the assignments? Is it about getting started on the assignments? Is it about knowing what your assignments are? Is it about getting them out of the backpack and into the basket at school? We think about it as being my kids having a hard time at school, instead of getting really more narrowed in and say, well, my kid is really having a hard time capturing assignments in second period because the teacher is shouting the assignments on the way out the door when the kid's worried about getting to third period class. Okay, well, we can solve, let's partner together, kiddo. That was a true example from my kid in seventh grade because the teacher would yell out the door, okay, read chapter 14
for
tomorrow.
Don't forget.
And he's like already worried about the crowd in the hall and the stress and the noise and the everything else. And so was missing all the assignments. Well, we can figure out, okay, let's partner with a second period teacher to figure out how to make sure you don't miss the assignments so that you're not surprised the next day when it's like, oh, wait, I had a test. I had no idea.
Just talking about school and ADHD puts my stomach in knots because this has been the biggest struggle as a parent of ADHD kids. I remember the shock I felt when I realized most of my kids would not be high-achieving students like I was, not because they weren't smart or invested or hadn't read early as children or whatever other reason, but because school was such a struggle with their ADHD. I have realized since that my kids are wonderful the way that they are, even if their scholastic paths haven't looked like mine, and that's fine. But I also wish we had taken more aim on particular school issues so we could have had more progress and less stress when they were in school. Another issue parents of ADHD kids often have to face is emotional dysregulation or unacceptable emotional responses from their kids. You're gonna hear the terms emotional regulation and co-regulation. And if you've misplaced your psychology glossary, I've got you. Regulation is referring to your ability to manage your emotions. Co-regulation means helping someone else manage their emotions. Diane and Elaine have some ideas on how to manage this as well, both in our kids and ourselves.
I was working with a mom of an elementary age kids this morning, a little boy who's having a really hard time with big emotions. And she comes to him in, with logic. He's like exploding. And she's coming to him, oh, sweetheart, if you could just calm down, we'll get our snack in 15 minutes. And we come with logic. And she's talking to an amygdala. And I, like, she had a dog sitting next to her. And I was like, it's kind of like if you went to your dog and said, oh, sweetheart, just wait. We'll have our snack after, you know, it's.
Let me show you the time chart that I've created. Let me show you the data. And I'm only making fun because I was that mom.
I'm me too.
Yeah. And so it's about understanding, number one, where they are relative to their availability to partner, whether they're overwhelmed or hyper-focused or emotional or just not available in the moment. And then it's our availability, right? Because so the other part of it is when we're upregulated, when we're overwhelmed, we're scared, we're frustrated, we're not problem solving, we're not partnering, we're in fix-it mode. And so it's that co-regulation, both paying attention to our own regulation and then noticing where they are and using tools to navigate that first instead of diving in and trying to solve the problem.
One of the techniques we teach, which sounds like it's not a technique, but it is, is instead of getting furious, get curious, right? To really begin whenever we notice ourselves getting agitated, upset, disappointed, frustrated, when the hairs on the back of our head, neck stick up, any of that stuff, is instead of getting angry or upset, is to get curious, well, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. What might be happening here? What else might be going on?
I appreciate that. Obviously, we need to emotionally regulate as parents in order to model correct behavior and also to live in this world. But learning to do it ourselves and encouraging that or teaching it in our kids is a different thing. Talk a little bit about the differences in emotional regulation.
What you just said is an important piece of it, because if we work on it as a family, if we normalize dysregulation, if we know that everybody gets upset, everybody gets wobbly, everybody gets overwhelmed, everybody gets flooded sometimes, it's what happens in our brain and our body. Parents who a lot of times, they know that they're contributing to the hot mess, the kid's contributing to the hot mess. Sometimes we can get our kids' buy-in to work on something that if it's about us. Part of my backstory as a recovering yelling mom was I sat down with my kids one day and I was like, I lost it yesterday and I'm so sorry and I don't want to do it. And I need help. I need to understand what's going on for you. I want to look at what's going on for me. Will you work with me on this so that I stop yelling as much, so that you maybe get less upset, that we're really partnering, working on this together. So it's the normalization that it happens to everybody. And it's the partnership to go, okay, wait, what does mom look like when she starts to get upset? Gee, when mom starts to get upset, she probably could use 5 minutes alone. Can we figure out how to give her some space and then figure out how to come back safely so that we can finish the conversation and not have you feel like we're going to just forget about it?
I'm going to be honest. I don't think my kids telling me to take 5 minutes to calm down would go over very well in my brain, in my house. I remember a time when apparently I was looking a little stressed, asking about my kids' assignments and schoolwork or whether or not they had done chores. I spoke in very calm terms. I was doing a really great job, for the record, and I had one of my kids look me in the eye and say, rather casually, hey, mom, do you maybe want to go to the gym? maybe you should just go to the gym for a minute, trying to distract me. So yeah, maybe my family, we'd approach it a little bit differently. But I do love the idea of being aware and compassionate when anyone in your family is starting to get wobbly, as Diane and Elaine would say.
We've created a very simple framework, which is aware, alert, alarm. We're either in aware, where we'd like to be, where we're available for problem solving, we're fine, we're grooving through life. When we get a little bit triggered, we move into alert. Alarm is when you get triggered to the point where you just can't recover from it and reclaim your brain, you're gonna escalate. And sometimes we just have to blow. Sometimes the kids just have to blow. They have to have the meltdown, the upset, the whatever, so they can recover. Our game is to recognize that our kids are in alert a lot of the time, to notice the things that trigger so that we can downregulate and it doesn't escalate. But we hear parents say all the time, my kid went from 0 to 100.
Yeah.
Chances are your kid's walking around at 40. And if we recognize that our kids are always at some level of agitation, very often, a lot of our kids, I was just on a call with a couple this morning where that was their insight and their takeaway is that this kid is always at 40 or 50. And so to get from 40 to 75 when he's going to blow is a whole lot closer.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And so as soon as a parent gets agitated, that agitates him, and then it just escalates. So we've got to recognize that we are not walking around in la-la land most of the time. Many of our kids are very often walking around in a somewhat agitated state, and they're closer to escalation.
The thing I would add to what you're saying is that that agitated state looks different in everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So the kid who's like grumbling and grumping and, I mean, those we can see. It's the kid who's in his room hiding, playing video games or not talking to his sister. We all have our way of shutting down, but that escalated state is that our emotional brain and our rational brain are competing with each other. And that's what makes it hard to engage. If I'm escalated or offline or over the top, it's not the moment to teach them anything.
Yeah, right? Good point.
I'm going back to the parent that was having a hard time with their 9-year-old, and it was the little sister, and it was the fighting with the little sister. And they had an agreement that says, if you hit your little sister, there's a consequence. But sitting there threatening, if you don't stop, you're going to have to X, Y, and Z is not going to work because he's not available. He's already escalated. But afterwards, having an agreement that says whenever we're unkind, we're going to say something nice. We're going to write a little love letter. We're going to, whatever it is that you're going to do to have a consequence for the negative. There's two reasons to have consequences. One is to send a message, which in this instance, we absolutely want to send a message that the behavior is not okay. The second is to change the behavior. And if you've got a neurodiverse kid, their ability to learn from their mistakes, their ability to respond to a consequence is going to be completely different than your average Joe kid.
You can be empathetic and still hold accountability. And in fact, when you do that, your kid feels like you're on their team. The advantage of having clearly communicated accountabilities and consequences, as Diane is saying, is that the kid knows what to expect. They have you on their team saying, I'm so sorry, you have to deal with this consequence, instead of, see, I told you, now you have to, right? I like to say, let the system be the bad guy. And we get to be on their team.
Let me just highlight what Diane and Elaine said, because there was a lot of good stuff in there. First, before we enter the fray with our kids, we need to gauge emotional availability in both our kids and in ourselves. Just be aware of the landscape. If either party is triggered or melting down, it's just not a good time to be making inroads. Let things calm down first and then dip your toe in the water. Second, our kids are on alert most of the time, and we may be missing the signs. So if they are blaming or complaining or avoiding interaction, that's a really good sign that they are on alert and an alarm is only a nudge away. The takeaway here, don't wait until you or your kid is in a full meltdown mode to try to address problems. Look for the warning signs and do your talking then. And finally, let the system be the bad guy. Establish consequences long before the bad behavior happens. Another thing Diane and Elaine suggest we do is play to the strengths that come with ADHD. I love this part.
There's a lot of evidence about the value of taking a strength-based approach.
Okay.
And our school system here in the U.S. functions on that performance paradigm, which is you're supposed to perform, and if there's an area where you're not as good as other things, then we're going to really focus on that deficit so that we can get you up to just average. And the truth is that our kids are specialists in a generalist's world. And if we play to the specialty, if we accentuate the strengths, and it's not that we don't attend to the deficits, but those deficits may never get to the level of strength, and that's okay. I mean, I was talking about my kid who's in med school now, right? This kid has dyslexia. Let's just say English and language arts is not their strength.
Okay.
But math and science was. And so we really played to the math, and they felt smart as a math kid, which was really important because they didn't feel so smart as an English kid. And so they needed to really see that they did have this extraordinary strength somewhere so that they could see themselves as a smart kid that they were, even if they were only getting B's or C's in English, because they knew that their gift was someplace else. And so there's a ton of evidence about this for all kids, but particularly when there's neurodiversity, that if we play to their strengths and just outsource the challenges, because we live in a world with spell checkers and calculators, then we can really help them feel their confidence and their competence, because that is what's going to set them up for success in life. That belief that they can is every bit as important as almost anything else we invite them to understand about themselves. There's been a lot of research done. The ability to make connections and to see how things relate is more common in people with neurodiversity, especially ADHD. That ability to be present, to be fully present, to hyperfocus. That's a strength. That sense of there's two time frames, there's now and not now. Well, if I can be fully present in the now, think about what that capacity is. Nobody can multitask. I call it rapid sequential monotasking. So ER docs, 70% of ER docs have ADHD because they can move from one thing to the next really quickly. So to Diane's point again, each of our kids has these incredible strengths that we often may not recognize our strengths, because we may very often see the things that are their greatest strengths as also the things that drive us crazy about them. So look to the things that aggravate a little bit, and you may find the strength underneath it.
I guess what I would say is that everybody's strengths are different. Yes, there may be some things that tend to be more prevalent in creativity or empathy or whatever it is. But the goal here is to watch your kid, notice your kid when they're in the zone, help them see what do they love about it. I remember sitting with my kid who's a gamer and going, what is it that you love about gaming? You're really good at this. What is it that you do that makes you good at this? And not just telling them what their strengths are, but helping them unearth it to go, oh, wait, I really love the strategy. Oh, wait, I really like the partnership of working with other kids towards a goal. Okay, great. Those are strengths, being able to be a team leader or being able to think strategically. Those are strengths that you have, or whether it's empathy and kindness. It's just watch your kid, see what they love, and find the strength in that. Because not only are they good at it, but it feeds them, which is what all of us magically want, right?
So often we think of ADHD as a broken cog in our kids' wheelhouse. But ADHD might just end up being the very wheelhouse itself, thanks to the creativity or empathy or hyperfocus that so often comes with it. And it is our privilege as parents to discover those strengths with our kids. I appreciate Diane and Elaine's coaching today. Everything from shifting mindsets, to taking aim on specific issues, to handling emotions, to focusing on the strengths that come wrapped up in the ADHD package. But one of the coaching tips that hit home the hardest for me had nothing to do with my kids and, well, everything to do with me as a parent.
We put our attention and our focus on our kids. It's like, my kid is struggling. My kid's having a hard time. Yeah. My kid doesn't have a job. My kid's struggling in school. Whatever it is, our heart and our work is designed to help parents understand that they can make a difference. It doesn't mean that you have to fix it, but sometimes it's just making subtle changes. It's about looking at your part in this, because the cool thing is, and the hard thing is, we can control ourselves. We can't control our kids, even if they're little. We think we can, or we think we can set the pace, but it should be empowering and scary all at the same time to know that it's about us, even if it's our kids that are struggling.
At the end of the day, the change we want for them starts with us. And that seems like a counterintuitive truth. But parenting is about the parent. We can make a huge difference by letting go of trying to control the dynamic and paying attention to how we respond to the dynamic.
Parenting is already a vulnerable place. Throw ADHD into the mix, and we might just want to go on strike. But I like this idea from Diane and Elaine that parenting is really about us, the parents. As much as we want to make it about the kids, their struggles, their choices, good parenting is really about you and me and how we want to show up for our kids. And hopefully, that's as the most informed, compassionate, and committed ADHD parents we can be.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio, hosted by Lisa Valentine Clark. This episode was produced by Erica Price with help from Becca Hurley-Lung, Blake Morse, and Kenny Mears, with post-production by Gracie Davis. A special thanks to today's guests, Diane Dempster and Elaine Taylor-Klaus of Impact Parents. A link to their website will be in the show notes. Don't miss out on two other great podcasts from the Lisa Show family, The Council of Moms and Proofread, a new book review podcast to help you read more of what you love. You can find The Council of Moms and Proofread on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for your messages. We read them all. And thanks for listening.
Are you looking to build better connections or bridge divides but struggle with the how? There's another podcast I think you'll love. It's called Uncomfy, Sticking with Moments That Challenge Us. It's an audio and video podcast brought to you by the BYU Radio family. Now on Uncomfy, you'll hear stories of real people in moments that really challenged their perspective. And instead of getting angry or shutting down, they stuck with their discomfort. Whether it's getting some tough feedback from a close friend or choosing to hear out a politically opposed colleague, they chose to stay open and curious, and they're glad they did. It's very empowering. New episodes of Uncomfy drop every Wednesday. You can listen or watch on the BYU Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.